I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. In the wake of the 2020 murder of George Floyd, the toppling of scores of monuments to the Confederacy made national and international news. But 4 years on, the vast majority of these monuments remained firmly in place. University of North Carolina at Charlotte historian and professor emerita Karen L. Cox spent much of her career studying the women responsible for building most of these monuments. She decided to write No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice, to help communities make informed decisions about what to do with this past. Her work sheds much needed light on the reasons why these monuments were built, why they've been defended and preserved, and the long struggle to denounce and remove them. Karen, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
At the start of your book, you explain that if communities are going to make informed decisions about what to do with these monuments, they really need to understand the context in which they were built. And then, so you lay that out in terms of people like Edward Pollard, who writes, who really coins the term, the lost cause. You explain, you know, what goes into this narrative about how the South explained defeat. So how did people like Edward Pollard explain the defeat? Why was that explanation so appealing?
Well, I mean, one of the things that he does is, and what the Lost Cause really becomes about, is to paint the Confederacy as a, and the soldiers as heroic, as having really a just cause. And it's on the one hand, it's partly an apology for defeat, but on the other hand, it's saying, you know what, you know, our cause was still just and sacred. And you know, as he gets towards the end of it, he talks about how, you know, despite military defeat, the Southern people remain committed to white supremacy and to the ideas that were set forth when Southern states seceded. So, and that's obviously around race, but he said the war doesn't decide, it didn't really decide anything, but military defeat and the end of slavery, which is really a basic premise of the Lost Cause. So he kind of lays it out, but then other people will pick that up and carry it forward and expand on it.
So how can we understand, how does he explain why this was such a just cause, of how the South was more in the right than the North?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I haven't read it all of his book. I mean, that book is 700 and some pages. I don't think I could stomach it. He's giving Southerners, white Southerners, an out. You know, he's just the things that I explained to you just a moment ago. But what happens is that, you know, as I said, people will expand on it. If you can see the war, if you can see it not in terms of defeat, but in terms of a noble cause, you can swallow that defeat a little bit easier. And then you can see these men not as having been emasculated by defeat, but to see them as noble warriors in the vein of a Robert E. Lee, for example. He is the main example. Then you can kind of change the narrative of what that all meant to you, and you know what defeat was about, and not even see it as defeat. It's almost as if, you know, it didn't happen, because white Southerners do is maintain the rightness of their cause and see all these, you know, defeated soldiers really as heroes. it kind of ennobles the Confederacy and ennobles the White South. And so, you know, it's a powerful, powerful narrative. And it's one that we still contend with to this day.
Okay. See, I thought part of it was, if you understand the true spirit of the Revolution, the South was more in sync with that than the North.
Well, there's always, it's not just that. Okay. So it's all of those things. It's what I just explained, but it's also that, I mean, certainly a strong thread in the Lost Cause is that, the South feels like it, that they are the natural inheritors of what the revolutionary generation accomplished. They believe that they are the most like those revolutionary ancestors, and that they are also better defenders of the Constitution, because they claim that the fight for the Civil War of the Confederacy was a was a fight over states' rights. And so, which is the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. So they see themselves as more patriotic, more in line with the Revolutionary War generation. Plus these all these other things. It's not one explanation. It's all of them.
Okay. And even if you take something like slavery, they'll contrast that with wage slavery in the North, for example.
Yes. And even Edward Pollard had done that, you know, in his previous books. He will say, you know, you, that's what you have. You're dealing with something like that. And trying to justify plantation slavery, and, you know, sort of the need of white Southerners to, you know, provide Christianity to these savages, or, you know, that they needed the, you know, the strong hand of the white man in order to give them guidance. So, yes. So they could not have imagined citizenship for the formerly enslaved. They could not even allow themselves to conceive of it, such that once the war was over and there were efforts at Reconstruction to help freedmen achieve achieve citizenship or navigate freedom. There are certain places, of course, where white Southerners continue to put up a fight and were exacted violence on the freedmen in their communities, because they just couldn't conceive of them being free, being citizens, and they wanted them to know that.
But is it fair to say that they reimagined slavery as kind of like a civilizing mission, that this isn't something that's going to be perpetual, that that this is a process of over time, helping Africans to become Virginians?
Well, I would, you know, not just Virginians, everybody.
And elsewhere, right? Just as one example.
You know, the entire South, it was like, of course, that's what I was saying about, we're going to Christianize these African savages. This is about, that is about civilizing them, not educate them, of course, but to civilize them by bringing, you know, the lessons of Christianity as they understood them. So their focus are on, you know, passages in the Bible that talk about slaves obeying their masters.
Hmm. Okay. So one of the things I thought was fascinating was this emphasis on all these opportunities that take shape after the war. And I guess I had always thought about wars maybe more in terms of the First and the Second World War is the door opens for opportunities during the war. Women enter into the workforce. They get access to jobs and options they didn't have before. And then the war ends, men return, and often it goes in the opposite direction. But the emphasis here is that you have a context where men are kind of broken after the end of the war, and women transition from maybe a role they had taken on initially into this new role of commemorating the dead. So could you talk a little bit about how does the end of the Civil War create these unique opportunities for these, at least for the middle and upper class women who form these first associations, like the Ladies Memorial Associations, to deal with commemorating the dead. So what opportunities to create, what kinds of practical experiences do they gain?
Well, they had already gained practical experience during the war as members of soldiers' aid societies. And those soldiers' aid societies then evolved into Ladies Memorial Associations. So there was a continuation of what had begun during the Civil War. And these women saw this as an opportunity to do good for their community. And it's also a means of saying, you know, without their saying point blank, we're not going back to the way things were before. It gave them an opportunity to navigate in public spaces, a leadership role, but all under the guise of commemoration, memorialization of the Confederacy and the Confederate dead. And so it began with them establishing cemeteries and raising money to establish those cemeteries. And so in many ways that they were the only ones who could really do it, because men are returning as the defeated, and they can't turn around and then sort of commemorate themselves or honor themselves. And so it falls on the women to do it, and they take to it with gusto, and it marks the beginning of what would be several generations of white Southern women engaging in the work of commemoration of the Confederacy. And so, of course, the Ladies Memorial Association would be followed up by the organization of the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1894.
So beginning with these Ladies Memorial Associations, their work is in cemeteries, and they're raising money for tombstones to have the remains of Confederate soldiers repatriated. But then it transitions into public spaces, into spaces like town squares, courthouse lawns. And I think the point that you make is that that happens really fast after, right after the end of Reconstruction. You have this transition, and it's very quick. And I think you take the case of the Augusta Confederate Memorial as an example of a whole new type of commemorative event that takes shape that's different from what was happening within the graveyards. So, how does that memorial work expand from the graveyard to these public spaces like town halls and courthouse lawns? How does the nature of commemorations, rituals, how do they expand? How do they take on a whole new tone and tenor?
Well, they're able to expand and consider public spaces once Reconstruction ends in their state. I mean, for all intents and purposes, that it has come to an end. In other words, there aren't federal soldiers on patrol or that kind of thing. And so once former Confederates retake their state legislatures and in various Southern states, then it opens the door for a more public commemoration of the Confederacy. And so the women are able to do that. And it becomes a little bit easier for men to do that now that they're back in power to participate in that. But usually the way they participate is by helping these women get the funds that they need in order to erect a monument. And so it swiftly moves after, you know, sort of beginning in the 1870s, say 1876, 77, depending on when former Confederates were placed back in office, but definitely by 1877, you see that this memorialization effort of the Confederacy, but moves from cemeteries into public squares or public spaces, and it becomes much more a celebration of the Confederacy. And I think that's probably made possible by the fact that they have, you know, former Confederate leaders have regained control of the politics in their state, from the state legislature down to the, you know, postal workers or whatever, you know, in a community. So they've regained some control, which is, you know, what they want to do anyway. This is like, can we in an effort to work toward reestablishing sort of the goals of what they had wanted to do to begin with, which was to maintain slavery in the absence of being able to maintain slavery. They could now, you know, institute laws that would bring the Black populations in the South under their control. And so once, if you could do that, then what you do is create a space, an open space for communities to raise money, often led by women, to celebrate the Confederacy. And again, it begins early, very early in Augusta, is probably the earliest, but it also begins 1877 when there are two Robert E. Lee Memorial Associations created, one for in New Orleans for the big monument that used to be there. It's since come down. And then also the Lee Memorial Association in Richmond, Virginia, that put up that large equestrian statue of Lee on Monument Avenue, also has been removed. But it's at that same time in 1877 that they're already raising money for these grand regional monuments, not just local but regional, and you can see it becomes a real celebration of the Confederacy, especially during their unveiling ceremonies.
And what impressed me is the extent to which these women just excelled at social networking. I mean, they were connected, they had relatives in the right places, but they were really good at working that network to generate a lot of money and to really create these celebrations with parades and thousands of people in attendance really early on. Going back, I think you mentioned Augusta was the first example of that.
Yeah, I mean, it really takes off under the UDC, because they are, that now we're talking about a second generation of women who have all that experience since the end of the Civil War, and who are connected by blood or marriage to men of power in the region. They're educated women. They're looking for a place to use their skill set. And frankly, these men who have been defeated during the Civil War, couldn't really argue with these women about this kind of thing, you know, that they would be the leaders of this effort. Plus, I mean, they get the benefit of being the ones who are being honored through these monuments.
Hmm. And I think you make the case too that in their places like Richmond with the Lee Memorial, that women are kind of taken on as consultants. They have experience, and they're pretty quickly take on the leadership role, and they're the ones who are really running the show.
Yeah, I mean, they have great fundraising experience, and they know how to get things done. I mean, these, you know, and so I think that the Lee Memorial, you know, it's like they basically said, you know, if we take this on, we're going to determine the, you know, the design of the monument, et cetera. There were male Confederate organizations that were clearly involved in the Lee Memorial, but when it came to getting the money, raising the money, and as they said, I think I say in there somewhere about women control the purse strings. And so they are the ones who can then determine things like what the design, who the sculptor is going to be, you know, where it's going, you know, who gets invited, who gets to speak, all of those things.
So you mentioned at one point that, because Robert E. Lee becomes like this, he takes center stage in the memorialization of the Confederacy, and that he himself during his lifetime was opposed to that. And So how, what was it about Lee that made him the most important symbol of the Confederacy?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One, first of all, it's true. Like, you know, he died in 1870. And so in some, and his thought was, we don't want to do that, that building monuments only keeps open the wounds of war. As he, I think he said something, I'm paraphrasing. And, but you know, he kind of becomes this, you know, the person who represents the Confederacy in all its goodness. Like he's the noble Christian warrior. He is considered, you know, he kind of helps it through the figure of Robert E. Lee and through the monuments to Robert E. Lee. It's like a reclamation of Southern white masculinity. And he's just seen as like, he's regarded as the, you know, the best, you know, military leader. He's, you know, because, and even though, of course, he made some real errors during the war itself, but he's considered just like almost untouchable because, you know, he represents this sort of special Christianity and the nobility of the cause. And, you know, how he, you know, gave up his, you know, commission in the United States Army to lead the Confederacy and things like that, that there were certain actions that they would focus in on. But he's, you know, he's one of the, I call the trifecta of people. He's number one, but it's also Stonewall Jackson. And then Jefferson Davis gets added into it. So those are the, and those is that, it's that trio that's on Stone Mountain Memorial outside of Atlanta, Georgia.
So one of the points that you make is that you really, to go back to that idea of that you really need to understand the context in which these monuments are built. So if you shift to the United Daughters of the Confederacy, the 1890s seems to be a major turning point where you have a transfer to this next generation, and the magnitude of memorial making becomes something, takes on a whole new level. You know, this goes back to these ladies' memorial associations, but once you get to the 1890s, the volume of memorials is just exponentially greater than anything that had happened before. And this is happening at the same time as Reconstruction comes to an end, and white Southern men are retaking control of legislatures, of courthouses, and you have this kind of interlocking system of these monuments that are built in these public spaces outside the courthouses, outside the state houses, in these public town spaces, spaces that were meant to be democratic, spaces of common ground, and they're being reclaimed for white Southerners, and you really need to understand how this kind of works in tandem. So, what was happening at the same time that you have this acceleration of monument building, and you have the acceleration of legislative means of reclaiming public spaces, and violence is accelerating for the same purpose.
I mean, the 1890s is just a watershed, you know, decade. It there's all kinds of things happening beginning in 1890. So that's 1890 is when the unveiling of the Robert E. Lee equestrian statue in Richmond occurred. It's also that year that we saw something called the Mississippi Plan put into place, which was a way of disenfranchising African American men from voting, and then they also put in things like into, you know, requesting that first of all there's a poll tax now. They'd have to pay a poll tax, or they'd have to sort of navigate what's known as an understanding clause. Someone would read a part of the Constitution to someone, and if they couldn't explain what it was, they could be, you know, eliminated from the rolls, voting rolls. And so that began, and then one state after another began passing a similar plan in their state. So that's happening. There's also an epidemic of lynching in the 1890s, which is kind of coincides with disenfranchisement, because they're trying to bring the black population under control, because essentially, you know, that they saw that black communities had organized, that there were individuals who were succeeding economically, and they wanted to bring that back under control, under white control. And so, and then there's also, you know, the rise of the social Darwinism kind of, you know, overlaps all of this. And so essentially it's about reestablishing white supremacy. Okay. And it's with that backdrop that that white Southerners not reclaim space, but they're claiming space. They're claiming the spaces around courthouses, on battlefields too, along public boulevards, but namely on the landscape around the local courthouse for these Confederate monuments. And so, and the UDC was founded in 1894, right in the middle of that decade. And as black men are disenfranchised and removed from the political sphere, in walks the United Daughters of the Confederacy, not as voting people, not as voting citizens, but as people who might lobby the legislature or lobby the local courts for their pet projects, which the most, you know, costly ones, of course, were these Confederate monuments.
One thing I couldn't help wondering was, and you make reference to this from time to time, is to what extent are Northerners also to blame? And you mentioned, well, that you know, the South loses the war, but they win the narrative of it. They win the memory of it. And this is something that Northerners capitulate to. They concede to. You had some illustrations where you're showing how Northerners are finding economic opportunities in the lost cause and nostalgia for the past. They're the ones that who are designing, building these monuments. And I found one of your illustrations that came from Confederate veterans. And I was looking through, and it was just fascinating because this was one of these public archive sources. And I couldn't help but to peruse some of these past ads. And so I would see ads, for example, like, here's a company from Pennsylvania, and they're selling grave markers. And they're saying, to parties ordering my CSA veteran grave markers during August, September, October, November 1909, at 25 cents each, I'll send one Confederate battle flag, fast colors, 6 by 10 inches, and mounted on flag sticks to fit my markers, with each marker without extra charge. I have only 1,200 to 1,500 flags to give away in this manner. Send your orders now, and be sure of the free flags of charge. So basically, the Northern companies that are, you know, marketing everything from grave markers, and they'll throw in a free flag if you're one of the first people to buy one of these, or Confederate uniforms. I saw endless ads for Confederate uniforms, Northern companies. So I thought, I couldn't help but wonder, I mean, this isn't something that the North holds some responsibility in what happens with this narrative.
Well, you know, they're capitalists. They saw, you know, that there was an opportunity to supply sort of the material culture of the lost cause, from flags to uniforms to
monuments
to all kinds of things. And it's also in, you know, the songs that are written about the South. These are something that, you know, in the early 20th century, the Tin Pan Alley composers wrote dozens of songs about the South, about Dixie, and basically romanticize it. And so They're complicit. I would say they're complicit. They're capitalists, but they're also complicit in helping to create an image of the South and of slavery as benign. And that's what's problematic.
And there are Northern newspapers that they're reporting on these unveiling ceremonies, and they're kind of selectively, they're leaving out certain things and including what they want to try to promote reconciliation.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think I give an example of that, but there is, even though there's, somebody might at this unveiling speech say how right the South was, and then have these other, a little less, I can't think of the word right now, but there, so maybe the rest of the speech talks about ideas of reconciliation. That's the thing that the Northern press wants to focus on. They don't want to talk about, these unreconstructed comments in some of these unveiling speeches.
But if there is one group that's speaking out early on, it's African Americans, and this is a point that you make there's a reaction to this from the very beginning, early on, there are black run newspapers who are sounding the alarm at the danger. They're important, prominent public figures like Frederick Douglass who are denouncing what's happening. So how are they sounding the alarm? What are they warning people about?
Well, I think that, both Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois, they were, commenting on the fact that Lost Cause narrative is winning about what the war was about, and then on the local level where Southern black citizens are the ones who are most affected by all of this. A man like John Mitchell Jr., who's the editor of the Richmond Planet, which is the black newspaper, and other black newspapers, they're sounding the alarm and saying, you know what, this is coinciding, this big celebration of the unveiling of the Lee Monument in Richmond is coinciding with the effort to roll back the gains that Friedman made through Reconstruction. And he was right. He talked about people being kicked off voting rolls and the poll tax and things that have actually come back full circle. Right now, we know that in the Georgia election and there were people who were booted off the rolls. Or the claim that they had died, so they felt like they were losing the gains that they had made in citizenship, and they saw that as tied to the lost cause, and that is a common theme. Like they recognize that, and each generation recognizes that, And I talk about the Chicago Defender. Posed a question about Confederate monuments, should they be made illegal or something like, should there be federal legislation prohibiting the building of Confederate monuments, to which black readers said was a resounding yes, because they saw the connection between these Confederate monuments and how it influenced younger generations of white Southerners. And I think one of the people said, one of the responders said, if these monuments didn't exist, that the white, I'm paraphrasing, but that the white South may not have as much of an excuse or, to hate our people. In other words, he saw that these monuments were contributing to racial hatred. So they just saw that as a fact. And so there's a long, long legacy of black critiques of monuments, and then protest against monuments. But the protests, at least public protests, really don't happen until the post-Civil Rights era, because, or the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, because it was a dangerous thing to do in the Jim Crow South. You wouldn't go protest a monument like some, you know, people have done in recent years, because they, you know, they would have been lynched.
But there were some monuments. You mentioned the Calhoun Monument that were vandalized, even in that age of mass terror.
Well, they didn't do it in public. They did it in the dark of night, or they did it where people, they couldn't be seen. So they weren't doing this. They knew, like, the white community didn't, if they could have identified someone who was to blame for defacing the Calhoun Monument, which led to it being placed on an even higher pedestal in Charleston. They would have taken care of those people, but it was being done in such a clandestine kind of way that they couldn't, like, pinpoint who it was, or most surely those people would have been arrested and sent to prison.
So you have this really effective interlocking system of Jim Crow laws, lynching terror, rewriting the past through these the work of organizations like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, the education work they did, the monuments that they put up. But eventually, social change happens, the country goes through the Second World War, African Americans fight that war, they expect after they've fought against fascism that changes should happen at home. Changes do begin to happen. And I think one of the points that you make is that in every instance where change occurs, there's a backlash. There's an effort to kind of retrench and behind the lost cause to fight against change. So what are some of these changes that are taking place? What's the backlash? How do you resist the changes that are taking place?
Well, I mean, the initial backlash, of course, is the backlash to Reconstruction. So any kind of racial progress, and the lost cause is all tied into all of that. And then you have a civil rights movement. Well, the response to that and the backlash to that comes from segregationists who employ the language of the lost cause. For example, you know, if Northerners come to assist Black civil rights workers, it's like in a quote unquote invasion of the South, in much the same way as they saw Northern invasion of the South during the Civil War. So there's this backlash against civil rights. Then you do have the civil rights movement, and you get about 25 years of progress post-Civil Rights, post-Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act. And then beginning in the 1990s, you begin to see the backlash again. And the backlash comes in the form of gerrymandering, which begins in the 1990s, and the rise of neo-Confederate organizations like the League of the South, which formed in 1994. So while women used to be the leaders of the lost cause, you begin to see men become that leadership. And so they represent, so in the 1990s, there's a backlash, political backlash, and involves, you know, the use of lost cause rhetoric. And then, you know, and so you see things like, I thought it was really interesting the way in which they twist language around to represent what they are. So they'll use the language of civil rights to say, well, you know, if we're going to have real equality, then we need to have Confederate monuments alongside a monument to Martin Luther King. Or during the period of, you know, multiculturalism in the late 20th century, it would say, well, we'd say you have the emergence of the term African-American, and they come back with Confederate American. And then more recently, Black Lives Matter has been met with people who talk about White Lives Matter or Southern Lives Matter. And Southern in this is doing the work of white supremacy. Or Confederate Lives Matter. I've seen that as well. So, there's this backlash. It's like I began this interview saying, you know, during the period of Reconstruction, that white Southerners could not even conceive of black citizenship. And I feel like in some ways, we see remnants of that, in our current political environment. It's like that citizenship needs to be controlled by a white patriarchy.
But black Southerners lose their rights in the course of the Jim Crow era. But you get to the post-war World War II era, the 1960s in particular, change happens. They regain the right to vote. Discrimination is outlawed based on race and color, religion, sex, and you get access to political offices for the first time since Reconstruction, and this begins to. So you have positions of more political influence, more of a voice in the system, and the way it seems to be expressed early on is a reaction against these symbols of the Confederacy. And you mentioned the examples of the Meredith March and the Tuskegee students who are reacting against incidents of racially motivated violence or racial injustice. And they target these symbols. They try to reclaim these public spaces. So what happens in those instances? How do these Confederate monuments get targeted during the Civil Rights era?
Well, it's in that immediate period right after, you know, the passage of the Voting Rights Act that you see, you have the Meredith March, but you also have, and this is in 1966, and you also have this murder in Tuskegee. But in the case of the Meredith March, what he's doing, he's testing the Voting Rights Act. He's like, is it real? If it's real, then what we're going to do is go, you know, register voters. So even though that was legal, they were too, and had been so intimidated in a place like Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, that they didn't even register to vote because they were fearful. And so this is a really important thing. But as they, you know, the march comes into towns in the Delta of Mississippi, the center of town is usually the Confederate monument, whether it's on a main street or it's at the courthouse. And so very often that's where they would meet. And so there, these spaces that had long been reserved for memorializing the Confederacy became a rally and a discussion about voting rights. In the case in Tuskegee, there was a young man who was murdered. And the man who killed him was set free, of course, and he even admitted to doing it. And so that led to a confrontation in the middle of Tuskegee, in the town of Tuskegee. Now the college is on the outskirts, but that's the center of town. And there they're having conversations about civil rights and about the ways in which these monuments represent the antithesis of black civil rights, but also and they begin to deface the monument in Tuskegee with the slogan "Black Power" across it. And so it's many decades before we've witnessed in more recent years with the vandalism of Confederate monuments, where they're being spray painted with different, you know, words and phrases.
And then, so once you get more access to the system and more Black representation within the system, you can start to object to maybe traditions and or funding of new monuments that wasn't possible before. And you mentioned a couple examples. Harvey Gantt was one in the case of Charlotte, which seemed unsuccessful, at least in the end. But at least you can start to voice opposition to these traditions and point out that there's more there than just a tradition.
Yeah, I mean, we have the first black elected official since Reconstruction in the 70s, some in the 60s even. But an individual like Harvey Gantt, who speaks very eloquently about the fact that, you know, he represents thousands of black citizens and why that history is not his history, the history of the Confederacy. Because there was an attempt to, and a successful attempt to place a new Confederate marker on the grounds of the courthouse in 1977. So we're talking 112 years after the end of the Civil War that people are still trying, you know, putting monuments up on the grounds of courthouses. So, yeah, I mean, he fails, but he leaves a record, right, for us to see how people were thinking at the time. So it's a powerful statement, but it couldn't have been made 10 years before because he wouldn't have been able to be elected because African Americans could not vote. And so that's a sea change. You know, the right to vote represents a sea change. And it allows for the kinds of things that were happening and, the election of black officials, their ability to voice their concern about Confederate symbols in their community. That's extremely important. But over the last 30 years, a lot of that's been chipped away.
So it seems like you have this pressure cooker that's building. On the one hand, you have this entrenched lost cause narrative. You have generations of educational work that have gone into that. And then you have the country is changing. You get more African Americans that are going into universities. They're taking up positions within government. You get legislative changes that are happening. And it's within this time period, like you mentioned, from, let's say, the 1980s to the 2015, that seems like resistance starts to radicalize, at least on the part of white Southerners, that it goes in a more violent, even more entrenched direction, and you get new organizations that are created that take on a different position. How do things become really precarious during this period of time?
Well, what we begin to see, we're experiencing a backlash against the civil rights movement and those, that legislation that was passed in the mid 60s and an attempt to reclaim power. So there it's a pushback against affirmative action. It's a pushback against the feminist movement. There's a backlash going on to a lot of different things, but in terms of neo-Confederate organizations, you begin to see, that's when you first see the League of the South emerge. But then there will be others. There's something, you know, begins to splinter. I mean, the Sons of Confederate Veterans is no longer the main Confederate heritage organization after the 1890s. It's one of many. And so it's definitely a backlash against racial progress in the period since the civil rights movement. It's not to say that black communities have, you know, just give up. You know, they continue to push against Confederate symbols in their communities, but, political pendulum is swinging hard right over the last few decades, and it And the thing about it is that the lost cause, people who believe in that, it fits for them. You know, it's like it's a conservative mindset about race, for example, that aligns with a lot of the conservative politics of, you know, again, the last few decades. And so the lost cause fits really well in there, and it becomes part of the Republican Party's culture war, you know, because it's not just, it isn't just Southern whites who defend Confederate monuments. It's people from all over the country that are defending Confederate monuments, but from removal. And there was one, the Utah Senator Mike Lee, for example, no relationship to Robert E. Lee. He talks, I mean, he tweets about, you know, how this is some big erasure of history, and, you know, and you know, basically upholding the Confederacy is, again, is like this noble history. And so he's playing right into the lost cause. But this is something that's been going on, you know, since the end of the Civil War. I mean, the thing that's interesting, I mean, you know, people talk about what's, you know, this kind of stuff emerges on Long Island, it emerges in Pennsylvania and other places in the North. And there's a joke that says, what is that area between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh? It's North Alabama. Because it is as Southern and conservative racially as, and you're as likely to see Confederate battle flags flying in the middle of rural Pennsylvania as you are to see them in Alabama.
Yeah, those symbols of intimidation have a long history in the North as well.
Yes.
But you get to the Charleston Massacre, right? And what was something that was maybe a regional issue goes national. So what is it about Charleston that makes this into a national conversation? And does it really change things? I mean, it changes things in South Carolina, but beyond that, what happens?
Well, I wouldn't say it changed much in South Carolina. I mean, what happens is, guess what? The Confederate monument is still there, right there on the state house lawn. But the Charleston Massacre, in which 9 members of Mother Emanuel Church were murdered by a young white supremacist, it hit national news. It was such an awful event. It shook people to their core. And not just in South Carolina. I think that a lot of people thought, you know, what it did was to, you know, for so long, people would say, you know, when something like this happens, it's a Southern problem. It's a, you know, this happens only there. But the reality is that people began to have conversations about symbols, divisive symbols in their own backyard. And so that, you know, leads to, you know, that is the beginning of a national conversation around Confederate symbols. And while Nikki Haley, who was then governor, she was not on board initially to removing the battle flag from the grounds of the state house. But she's kind of pushed in that direction. And then it's met with all kinds of, you know, protests from neo-Confederates waving hundreds of these flags around the state house, as it was being, you know, to hopefully prevent it from being removed. So it stirs people up in South Carolina, and it stirs people up nationally. And some of the backlash to it, at least in the South, are the passage of heritage laws, monument laws, or heritage preservation acts, or something like that. That basically are laws to protect Confederate monuments in those communities.
So, if you're going to understand the violence that that happens in Charlottesville. My sense is it comes out of this gridlock, right? That you get an effort to entrench behind these memorials, these monuments, an effort to protect them through legislative measures. There's no real way to remove them. You get more radical groups. You get this violent incident that happens in Charlottesville, and then after the murder of George Floyd, there's a violent backlash to these monuments because there's maybe no other way to react to them.
Well, that's true. I mean, the what happened in Charlottesville was, you know, an organization of people who, you know, or of several groups, not all of whom were Southerners, first of all, not all of whom, you know, believed in, you know, or had a Confederate heritage. It was a white nationalist gathering and was intended to be that way. It was a gathering of white supremacists. They basically got an endorsement from the then president of the United States. And unfortunately, a young woman was killed there, Heather Heyer, who was a peaceful protester at that. And then you have, and so I'm thinking, you know, this is really bad. It's just, you know, and then you begin to see the first of monuments coming down. But then it's the George Floyd moment of his murder in Minneapolis that I don't think people always understand why this would lead to vandalism of Confederate monuments in Richmond, Virginia, since this happened, you know, in Minneapolis. But it's because the monuments are regarded as symbols of white supremacy, and that act of white supremacy of the cop putting his knee on George Floyd's neck and basically killing him is these monuments are symbolic of that to Southern communities. And then, you know, of course, it led to all kinds of protests worldwide. I mean, it really expanded the ways in which people thought about monuments in their communities and what did that represent, and what, if anything, were they going to do about it?
If you're watching the TV news, you get the sense that following the murder of George Floyd, you have this surge with the Black Lives Matter movement and a toppling of monuments and places like Richmond. Suddenly, you get these monuments that are taken down in dramatic speed, and in some cities like New Orleans are even out ahead of this and removing them on their own. But if you're looking at the actual number of Confederate memorials or monuments, how much of a dent is actually made in the number following the in terms of the monuments that are removed after the murder of George Floyd? How many actually are still there? And then if you're looking at communities that are still dealing with this past, you mentioned South Carolina, the monument is still there outside the State House to the Confederacy. Are some communities managing, in your opinion, managing this past better than others?
Well, so in terms of numbers of just monuments, people confuse numbers because monuments are not, you know, are when I'm talking about the statuary, you know, not about a building name or a street name or anything like that. So there were, say, approximately 800. And there's still well over six, you know, almost 700. There's 100, and I think the last thing I heard was 160 had been removed. So that's still 640 monuments left, if that's an accurate number. Again, but that's what we're in the ballpark. So it's just a dent in that. And then, of course, the monument laws that have been passed that, you know, in Florida, they made it a felony, like a second degree felony, if you did something like come and rip a monument down. You could go to prison for it. So it, you know, I think different communities handle it differently. you know, New Orleans was able to get the jump on that because it was before, you know, what happened with George Floyd is before the laws were changed, even in Louisiana. The monument law in the state of Virginia, changed that, returned local control, to those governments. And that meant that, the mayor of Richmond could make the decision to have these removed, along Monument Avenue. And so, that's what allowed Richmond to do that. In urban areas where there's more of a larger tax base, there's a little more money, those communities have opportunity to be a little more creative in reimagining their landscape, while rural communities are still clinging to that single soldier on a pedestal at their local courthouse. So a lot of this has to do between the dividing line between urban and rural and what happened.
Karen Cox, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Karen L. Cox is a historian and professor emerita at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I've been talking with her today about her book, No Common Ground: Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. Word of mouth is always the best way to inform others. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.